Good afternoon, everyone. I call this meeting of the Senate Education Committee to order. It is 3:30 p.m. here on Friday, March 20th. We are meeting in the Belts Committee Room here in the State Capitol Building, located in incredibly snowy downtown Juneau. I have heard from a very reputable source that if we just keep snowing for a couple more days, we may break the record. I just want to remind folks who are here in the room, if they could please mute their cell phones. Documents for today's meetings have been distributed to members. They are also uploaded on BASIS, which is available at akleg.gov, and additional copies are available for folks right there by the door. All right, members present today are President Stevens, our Vice Chair, Senator Keel, Senator Yunt, Senator Bjorkman, and myself, Senator Tobin. Please let the record reflect we do have a quorum to conduct business. I want to thank Chloe for joining us from the Juneau LIO and Mary Gwen from Senate Records for joining us as well for documenting today's meeting. On the agenda today, we will have the first bill hearing for Senate Bill 232, Personal Collection of Certain Fossils. We will also have the first hearing for Senate Bill 228, Opioid Awareness Program. We will hold the second hearing for Senate Bill 187, Prohibiting Certain Food Additives in Public School Meals. I believe we also have a committee substitute for that legislation. And I am adding Senate Bill 110, Museum Construction Grants, to the agenda under bills previously heard. We will be taking public testimony on Senate Bills 232, Personal Collection of Certain Fossils, and Senate Bill 228, Opioid Awareness Program. If you would like to provide public comments during our public testimony, please call one of these following numbers. If you're calling from Anchorage, the number is 907-563-9085. From Juneau, the phone number is 907-586-9085. From all other locations, you can call this toll-free number, 1-844-586-9085. You can also testify from your local legislative information office or email your testimony to senate.education@akleg.gov. That is senate.education@akleg.gov. All right. Moving on to today's agenda, our first item is Senate Bill 232, relating to the collection of certain fossils. Senate Bill 232 is sponsored by Senator Yunt. Here with us today is his legislative aide, Ryan McKee, to introduce the bill. Mr. McKee, if you could please identify yourself for the record and begin your introduction.
All right, thank you. For the record, Ryan McKee, staff to Senator Yunt. SB 232, fossil collecting is a common practice for many Alaskans for personal enjoyment and education. Currently, collection of fossils from state land per AS 4135210 is a Class A misdemeanor and subject to a maximum civil penalty of $100,000 for each infraction. This legislation is to allow the collection of common invertebrate and plant fossils for personal use and education on state lands while still protecting vertebrate fossils, which are important for scientific purposes. And then we do have someone for invited testimony who can kind of get into this a little deeper.
Thank you. Well, we'll move on to your invited testifier. We have with us Bob Cassell. Bob Cassell. Mr. Cassell, if you could please identify yourself for the record and begin your testimony.
Sure. Bob Cassell here, calling from my home in Wasilla. So I'm interested in paleontology and fossils. I became aware that it was illegal on state lands, pursued DNR to get a clarification on that. It sounds like this regulation was included in the Preservation Act for Antiquities, and the fossils were included in that. I think that was a pretty good oversight. I did consult with Dr. Pat Druckenmiller regarding this. So on BLM, that is federal grounds, it is legal to collect invertebrate fossils and plants, and so this is to match that type of regulation. My goal would be to be able to take somebody from one of the rock clubs and take them in the back of my airplane, a child, and not have to tell them it's illegal to collect fossils. I take adults and I do that, but this would be sort of an education opportunity. I find it very fascinating, and I'm happy to entertain questions.
Thank you. Do we have any questions from committee members? President Stevens.
Well, thank you, Madam Chair. I don't know how to start this, but as a former history professor at the university, I know that my colleagues in areas like paleontology get very possessive of anything you do that might somehow affect the scientific purposes. So have you talked to a paleontologist at the university? Have you made that connection? And I would just like to know, I know the those folks who deal more with the vertebrates would be particularly concerned if we allowed that to be collected randomly. I'm just concerned, the scientific community, what would the response be, and can we have a connection with a paleontologist to find out their thoughts on it?
Sure. So Dr. Pat Druckenmiller, I did consult. I've actually taken two classes with him through the university. In fact, I donated $50,000 last year. That's how interested I am, and $5,000 the previous year to the University of the North Paleo program. They're sponsoring a couple of students up there. That's how interested I am. Certainly, Pat has had some input in this, and basically it's to mirror what's allowed on BLM lands to allow basically education, personal enjoyment, recreation, but absolutely preserve important vertebrate fossils that are important scientifically, as well as tracks from dinosaurs, that sort of thing, which is being studied. And so it's important that there is a distinction here that this delineates. In other words, preserve vertebrate fossils and allow collection with non-power tools, minimal disturbance, minimal amounts for education, recreation.
Follow up?
Well, I'll just say thank you, Mr. Castle. I appreciate what you're saying. It makes sense to me, but I'm not an expert in that field, and I would just encourage to Ryan to make sure we get some testimony from folks who are experts in the field. The University of Alaska, I know, has paleontologists. I can give you a telephone number if you wanted it.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. President. We do have online from the Department of Natural Resources, Division of Parks and Outdoor Recreation, State Archaeologist Nick Schmuck. And we also have from the Department of Natural Resources, Division of Parks and Outdoor Recreation, Office of History and Archaeology, the Acting Chief, Sarah Mateel. And I apologize, Sarah, if I mispronounce your last name. Any additional insight or context you would like to provide, Ms. Mateel or Mr. Schmuck? I'm going to say probably not. Senator Keel.
Thanks, Madam Chair. A question maybe first for the sponsor's office, and then we might push to the departments. I think on BLM land, there's both a daily and an annual limit on how much you can collect. Did you consider matching the 250 pounds a year rule that the feds have on BLM land?
For the record, Ryan McKee, staff to Senator Yunt, through the chair, Senator Keel. I don't believe we might see if Bob online has an idea on that. We haven't, but we can definitely look into that.
Mr. Castle, do you have any insight?
What's your question?
I apologize. Senator Keel asked a question related to mirroring the BLM annual limit in this commiserate version of personal collection outlined in Senate Bill 232.
Yes, that was the goal, to mirror their regulations. I believe it was 25 pounds, minimal disturbance, no power tools. And a caveat, if something scientifically important is found, is to leave it in the field. That's delineated in the BLM regulations, and let a paleontologist know.
Senator Keel?
Oh, thanks, Madam Chair. Mr. Castle, the question was about the 250-pound annual limit. Presumably you're not pulling 250 pounds back on your airplane each time. Would that be workable?
Oh, absolutely. Yeah, that's a good idea. I was not aware there was an annual limit. I was was not aware of that. That's a great idea. I support that.
Senator Keel.
another question then for the sponsor's office. As I look around elsewhere in this chapter in the law, there's references to the state's historical artifacts and resources, including the fossils and the like. there are references to important indigenous resources, which some of which I'm sure are going to be village sites and references to some of those. Is there any consideration, any possibility of giving, whether it's Parks and Outdoor Recreation or the Historic Preservation Office, the ability to designate a limited scope, and we wouldn't want them to go statewide, we wouldn't want anybody to go whole hog, but if there are particular sites where invertebrate fossils of these sorts of things are especially important to limit personal collection on some of those important historic or important cultural sites, think about that.
For the record, Ryan McKee, staff to Senator Young, through the chair, Senator Keel. Yeah, absolutely. We would definitely not want to do anything that would be bringing more people onto indigenous properties or taking things out that might upset certain areas. So absolutely, we would definitely entertain that.
Okay. Senator Keel.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I wonder if the folks online from DNR have thoughts on that. Is that a welcome change? Is that unnecessary? Do they already have that ability?
Mr. Schmuck or Mrs. Mateel, any insight or thoughts to Senator Keel's question?
Good afternoon. This is Sarah Meidel, acting chief of the History of Archaeology. Through the chair, yes. At present time, we would need to be working with the lands, Department of Natural Resources, Division of Lands, to be able to do that sort of a thing. Right now in our regulations, we don't currently have the ability to set aside places to say certain activities may or may not occur. At the present time, our authorities are limited to issuing permits, monitoring those permits, and assisting the state with things like construction project review.
Thank you.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'd be interested in working with the sponsor's office on some limited ability for the highest value sites. I wouldn't want it to be, you know, a blanket authority. But other than those two items, I appreciate the sponsor bringing forward the bill. There used to be an old strip mine in Senator Rauscher's district, and I remember going and looking at some petrified wood and being fascinated, and I don't remember if any of it ever went home or anything, but I'd hate to think that any laws got broken.
Thank Only $100,000. So.
Thank you. Thank you, Senator
Keel. It's been a long time.
Are there additional questions from committee members? Mr. McKee, I have two questions. The first, I see here on page 2, line 9, which is subsection B, a person engaging in personal use is responsible for ensuring personal use collection occurs in an open area and that the certain fossils collected meet the criteria for personal use. What happens if someone is found to not be in compliance with this section? What's the penalties?
For the record, Ryan McKee, staff to Senator Yunt, and I'll have Bob confirm with me, but I'm pretty sure that you would still be under the same fines and as it is originally. What we're looking for is we don't want to basically a permit that would allow you to do this as long as you abide by the certain rules stated in section 4135.085. If you go outside those guidelines, though, then you would be subject to breaking that permit that you were issued.
And Mr. Castle, do you have insight on what those penalties might be?
Please repeat, I was cut out.
In the legislation, it says that a person is responsible for insurance with compliance of the criteria that's outlined in the bill. And if my question is, if they are not in compliance, what are the penalties?
Well, I think it should go up to what it is currently under the Historical Preservation Act. If somebody messes with or disturbs vertebrate fossils, it should be a high penalty. Yeah, certainly, the letter I got from DNR is commensurate with the infraction. Of course, I think if you're selling them, that's pretty clear that that's illegal. If you're going over the limit, then probably a smaller fine. But I would not change the fine. I would allow the judge or whatever jurisdiction to make the fine commensurate with the infraction. And there was a question about areas that would be perhaps protected. The paleontologist, Dr. Druckenmiller, suggested Fossil Point, which is down adjacent to Lake Clark National Park. That's a pretty famous area. That beach is state land, and that would be something that could be included to protect completely, even from invertebrate fossil collecting. People do see that. It'd be nice to see that preserved, if that's possible.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Castle. I appreciate that and that insight. And I believe Senator Keel will be working with the bill sponsor to provide the authorization to DNR to ensure that certain lands are removed from possible collection sites. With that, I think my second question here, Mr. McKee, is particularly on I'm going to use the word disposal, but that might not be the correct word. When a person is finished with their personal collection, or perhaps they have passed, what is the process for them to transition those fossils into another iterative of existence?
For the record, Ryan McKee, staff to Senator Yunt. Are you talking about them basically when they're done digging up and then removing it from the state land?
Mr. McKee, yes. So here it says on page 2, lines 4, 5, 6, and 7, personal use collection may not be used for research purposes or the collection of fossils that will be made available for the general public through an institution or museum. And I'm particularly thinking of Mr. Castle has said that he's collected many fossils and that he's done this with his children. When he passes and is no longer with us, what happens to his collection? Where can it go?
That is a good question. I'll have to look into that, see if maybe Bob has that answer. I do not, but I can get that back to you if he's not able to answer it.
Mr. Castle, did you hear my question?
Yes. So for them to be scientifically important, they need to have data collected and recorded. That is GPS coordinates, date, strata, that sort of thing. I've not done that personally because, at least on state land, at this point, it's because it's illegal. I would do that if I felt like it was illegal, and if it was legal, then it could be donated to science, although invertebrate fossils are, they're common. The museum's not going to want them, even if I have good data. It would only be something that's scientifically important that they would want to have there. So I would say being able to gift afterwards would be okay. I think it best to keep them in the state. I think there could be abuse of somebody gifting and going outside. I also see potential for tourism. The two rock clubs here, both in the valley and then in Anchorage, regularly go up to Sutton and up into the Talkeetna Mountains and collect as a club these invertebrate fossils. I can see people coming from the lower 48 to do that. I just returned from England, Isle of Wight, where I went, where it was legal to collect, and got a good education from a tour guide for 4 days on the beaches of Isle of Wight, where the strata is very well known.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Castle. Well, I will work with the bill sponsor as well, and we'll figure out a disposal path, although I don't like using that word, but I cannot think of another word. Any additional questions from committee members? Seeing none, any other thoughts, Mr. McKee, before we move on to fiscal notes? Excellent. Well, we are joined by State Archaeologist Nick Schmuck from the Alaska Department of Natural Resources, who is here to walk us through the fiscal note.
Hi, yeah. So at the present fiscal note, as you see, it's listed as a zero fiscal note. So it would be keeping the existing permit system intact. You know, we have a system under 11A16 for issuing permits under 4135 00. This would be creating a new personal use category to allow people to collect limited amounts of certain invertebrate plant fossils on most DNR managed lands. Those collections cannot be sold, used for research, or made with anything other than hand tools, and they effectively transfer ownership of most collected fossils away from the state. This change introduces enforcement challenges around weight limits, tool restrictions, and preventing commercial diversion. Overall, the bill opens significant fossil resources to public collection, while maintaining protections for vertebrate fossils and formal research activities. And I apologize. My name is Nick Schmuck. I'm the State Archaeologist with the Office of History and Archaeology, Division of Parks and Outdoor Recreation, through the chair.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Schmuck. You caught yourself before I could ask you to identify yourself. Any questions on the fiscal note? Seeing none and no additional questions, I will now move on to public testimony. I now open public testimony for Senate Bill 232. Is there anyone here in the room that would like to testify? Seeing none, is there anyone online? Seeing none, I will now close public testimony. Any additional or final comments, Mr. McKee? Excellent. Well, we will hold Senate Bill 232 to a future meeting. Please work with myself and the bill sponsor on any amendments, and we will work with Mr. McKee and Senator Yunt to get this bill ready for its next hearing. With that, we'll move on to our next item on the agenda, which is the first bill hearing for Senate Bill 228 relating to opioid abuse awareness and prevention in Alaska's public schools. The bill is sponsored by Senator Rauscher. He is joined here by his legislative aide, Isabel Ordaz. Oh, I know I mispronounced that. I apologize. If you would please join us here on the dais and introduce yourselves and this legislation.
Thank you, Madam Chair, Vice Chair Stevens, and members of the Senate Education Committee for hearing SB 228. For the record, my name is George, Senator George Rauscher, District O. And so I'll begin my testimony. The Alaska is confronting an opioid and fentanyl crisis that continues to claim lives at alarming rates, exceeding national averages. Opioids, particularly fentanyl, are the leading cause of drug-related deaths and are increasingly found in Alaska. Young people are being exposed to these substances earlier, often without understanding of the risks. And our friends, our loved ones, our families across the state are paying the price. This crisis has driven bipartisan action at the national level, with Alaska families playing a direct role in shaping federal policy. In 2022, Sandy Snodgrass, an Anchorage mother who lost her 22-year-old son, Bruce Snodgrass, to an accidental fentanyl overdose, worked alongside Alaska's congressional delegation to advance federal legislation known as Bruce's Law. Senator Lisa Murkowski shared Bruce's story on the United States Senate floor and urged her colleagues to support stronger fentanyl prevention and education efforts, recognizing that awareness and early intervention are essential to saving lives. The provisions from Bruce's Law were included in the SUPPORT Act and were signed into law last year. SB 228 brings these national lessons home to Alaska by requiring Department of Education and Early Development to develop an opioid abuse awareness and prevention curriculum for students in grades 6 through 12. School districts would be mandated to teach the curriculum every year during or close to Red Ribbon Week, which is the last week of October. By ensuring students receive accurate, age-appropriate information about opioids and fentanyl during their school years, this bill aims to intervene before tragedy occurs. SB 228 focuses on equipping young Alaskans, our future, with the knowledge to recognize danger, to make informed decisions, to seek help early. It represents a proactive step to honor the lives already lost, support families, and reduce the likelihood that future generations of Alaskans will experience the same preventable loss that has already stolen so many of us before. So I do want to thank you for hearing this bill, but right now I'd like to turn this over to my staff, Isabel Ordaz, and to read the sectional analysis.
For the record, Isabel Ordaz, staff to Senator Rauscher. So Section 1 adds a new section, Section 14.30.363, to read Opioid Abuse Awareness and Prevention Curriculum. Subsection A requires the Department of Education and Early Development to develop an Opioid Abuse Awareness and Prevention Curriculum for students in grades 6 through 12 that relates to the physical, psychological, physiological consequences, and dangers to opioid abuse and opioid addiction. Lays out requirements that the curriculum must provide at least 60 minutes of instruction annually and include the dangers of opioid use, including drugs that may contain fentanyl, awareness of opioids designed to target children, including fentanyl-laced substances made to resemble candy, the scientific effects of opioid use, including drugs containing fentanyl, prevention strategies, including the safe use of prescribed opioid medications, and recognition of early warning signs of opioid addiction in school-aged children. Subsection B requires that the Department of Education and Early Development consult with the Department of Health, state and tribal entities, state residents with experience in opioid overdoses, and family members of individuals who have experienced an opioid overdose when developing the opioid abuse awareness and prevention curriculum. Subsection 6 requires school districts to teach the curriculum annually to students in grades 6 through 12 during or close to Red Ribbon Week in October. And subsection D defines curriculum, drugs, opioids, opioid abuse, addiction, and school district.
Thank you. Are there any questions from committee members? I have two questions, and it's both on page 2, starting on line 15. And this is just a question I have because I do know that some of our schools, particularly some of our charter schools, use a standards-based model where they don't have students who actually go to grades, that they are in mixed classrooms. And so just curious if there is some flexibility on the grades 6 through 12 to ensure that we're encompassing standards-based grading practices where there is not someone who's in third grade or fourth grade or fifth grade, but they might be at fourth grade math and sixth grade math or sixth grade reading.
Representative Rauscher, Senator Rauscher, District O for the record. So, Madam Chair, we would be happy to look at that. And I think it's going to take a little bit of studying to figure out the age appropriate for this, but I appreciate your thought on that one, and we would like to look into it, come back and let you know what we came up with or talk to you privately in your office so you can think about that in the future, and we will definitely come up with something.
Thank you. Thank you, Senator Rauscher. And then my second question is related to correspondence students who are not actually physically in class. Would this materials and curricula be available to those families if they would choose to use it?
So through the chair, Senator Tobin, so this curriculum would actually be provided for digital use. So once the curriculum is completed, then it would be distributed to all the school districts, and they would be able to use that curriculum digitally.
Thank you, and I appreciate that. I do know that sometimes with parents, having it where it sometimes isn't digital, as I know some of our families choose not to use digital resources, it might be helpful to create ones that are also paper-based.
Thank you.
Any other or additional questions that I see? None. We'll now move on to your invited testifiers. We are joined first by Michael. Oh, goodness. I think I'm on the right one. Oh, there we go. Michael Carson, the chair of the Mat-Su Opioid and Youth Task Force, who is joining us via teleconference, I believe. Mr. Carson, can you hear us?
Yes, I can.
If you could please identify yourself and begin your testimony.
Thank you. Good afternoon. My name is Michael Carson. I'm the Vice President and the Recovery Specialist of my house in Mat-Su. I also chair the Mat-Su Opioid and Youth Task Force. Thank you for this opportunity to provide public testimony in support of SB 228, Opioid Abuse and Awareness in Public Schools. Since 2015, Alaska has lost 2,000 individuals to a fatal drug overdose. And those are the ones that have been reported. There could easily be 200 or more due to families concerned about stigma or just lost bodies. The majority of those that have died due to the deadly synthetic drug fentanyl, which is 50 times more powerful than heroin. Just the amount that fits on the tip of a pencil can be fatal. Now, every illicit pill of Percocet, Xanax, Oxycontin, and even Adderall have the potential of a fatal overdose due to counterfeiting. We know from the YBRS, 7 to 15% of Alaska youth report misusing prescription pain medication. Unfortunately, many of you, Alaskan youth, are using drugs to self-medicate their mental health symptoms. 53% of Alaskan youth are not aware or knowledgeable about fentanyl. That's why SB 228 is so important. We need to educate our youth about the deadly consequences of fentanyl. Finally, I highly suggest that youth are added to the list of stakeholders with need to develop drug prevention curriculum. Their voices are imperative to ensure the curriculum is relevant to their lives and the challenges they face every day. We owe it to them. They are truly our future. Thank you for supporting SB 228 for opioid awareness in public schools. Thank you very much.
Thank you, sir, for your testimony. Are there any questions from committee members? Seeing none, we will move on to our next invited testifier. I believe we are joined here in the room by the founder of Alaska Fentanyl Response, Sandy Snodgrass. Ms. Snodgrass, if you could please join us here, identify yourself for the record, and begin your testimony.
Good afternoon. First, I'd like to thank Senate Education Committee Chair Tobin for calling this hearing today. My name is Sandy Snodgrass. I'm the director of AK Fentanyl Response. Before I begin my testimony today, I'd like to take a moment to observe a moment of silence to honor those Alaskans who've lost their lives to the fentanyl crisis in our great state of Alaska. Thank you. My only child, Robert Bruce Snodgrass, lost his life to fentanyl October 26, 2021. He was 22 years old. Bruce was born and raised in Alaska. He was a true Alaskan boy. He loved everything about Alaska. He was an avid outdoorsman. He was a free solo mountain climber. Bruce had a plan for his life. He was a certified mountaineer. He was a guide, and he planned on guiding people through the mountains of Alaska to share with them the Alaskan wilderness that he so loved. I was prepared one day to get a phone call that my son had been in some sort of backcountry accident. That's not the call I got on October 26th in 2021. Instead, I received a call from the police to inform me that my only child's body was found less than a mile away from our home in the woods beside a Carr's grocery store within 30 feet of a Wells Fargo and a McDonald's drive-thru. 2 months after that horrific day, I received my son's toxicology report stating that the cause of death was acute fentanyl toxicity. Since that day, I've dedicated my life to raising awareness to the dangers of fentanyl. Today, I'm here to advocate for the swift passage of Senate Bill 228. This bill will provide vital education to Alaskan school children to give them the facts that they need to make an informed decision about experimenting with any illicit drug. I believe that educating our children is the golden ticket to reduce demand and begin to prevent the illicit drug use that has caused so much havoc, deaths, addiction, devastation of families in Alaska. So, you know, I'd say to kids that I see all the time when I do presentations, I end with this. If you never try an illicit drug, you can never die from an illicit drug. It's 100% preventable. This bill can begin to do that for the state of Alaska. It can reduce demand. It can prevent deaths. It's upstream prevention for our young people that they, it's just not an era that we can experiment with illicit drugs like I grew up in Alaska, where you know, that was a rite of passage. That simply is not the case anymore. That's just not where we live in this country anymore. Any experimentation of any illicit drug could cause immediate death. So this bill will, I also believe, be the first view to the country of what Bruce's law can look like. I think we can be the leaders in the country with this law to roll out what Bruce's law can look like to the rest of the country. So I'm very hopeful that that happens. That honors my son. That honors Alaska. So thank you for listening and hopefully passing this through your committee as soon as possible. Thank you for your time.
Thank you. Thank you for your testimony. Any questions from committee members? Thank you again for sharing your story with us. We'll now move on to the final invited testifier. We are joined online by the executive director of NAMI Alaska, Ann Ringstad. Ms. Ringstad, if you could please identify yourself for the record and begin your testimony.
Thank you, Madam Chairperson and members of the Senate Education Committee. My name is Ann Ringstad, executive director for NAMI Alaska, the statewide organization for NAMI, the National Alliance on Mental Illness. Thank you for allowing us to address Senate Bill 228 today regarding opioid abuse awareness and prevention and what can be done at the state policy level to protect youth behavioral health. We want to thank Senator Rauscher for introducing this important legislation. Today's drug landscape is fundamentally different from what it was even a decade ago. Fentanyl has become the leading driver of overdose deaths in the United States, and counterfeit pills containing fentanyl are increasingly circulating in communities across the country. Alaska is not immune to this trend, and I think Michael Carson gave some really good data, so I won't go into that, but I can say that many overdoses occur because individuals do not realize the substance they're taking contains fentanyl. For youth, this lack of awareness can be deadly. One pill can kill. Yet many young people are unaware that pills that appear to be prescription medications, such as oxycodone or Percocet, may actually contain, be counterfeit and contain fentanyl. According to SAMHSA and the National Institute on Drug Abuse, Alaska should strongly consider establishing a mandatory age-appropriate fentanyl and substance use prevention curriculum in schools statewide for grades 6 through 12. Evidence shows that early developmentally appropriate prevention education helps reduce substance misuse and equips young people with the knowledge needed to recognize risk and make safer decisions. In a state as geographically large and diverse as Alaska, schools should provide one of the most reliable ways to reach young people consistently. A statewide curriculum would ensure that every student, whether they live in Anchorage, a rural hub community, or remote village, receives the same evidence-based education about fentanyl, counterfeit pills, and overdose prevention. In closing, if we know that a single pill can take a young life, then we also know that knowledge can save one. And ensuring every Alaska student receives age-appropriate fentanyl education is a step we cannot afford to leave to chance. I commend Sandy Sock Snodgrass for taking on this fight and this awareness, and thank you for your testimony. My testimony.
Thank you. Thank you, Ms. Ringstad. Are there any questions? Seeing none, we'll now move on to a review of the fiscal notes. We are joined in person by Kelly Manning with the Department of Alaska Education and Early Development. Ms. Manning is the Deputy Director of the Division of Innovation and Education Excellence. If you could please identify yourself and walk us through the fiscal notes.
Good afternoon. For the record, I am Kelly Manning, Deputy Director for the Division of Innovation and Education Excellence. For OMB Component 2796, we have a fiscal note with a total fiscal note amount of $116,000. And this is for the development of the curriculum. There's a few provisions here asking the department to convene a group, Department of Health, Educator educators and families and those impacted by fentanyl abuse overdose. And so the department would convene that working group with a specialist in the area of opioid overdose to assist in developing the essentially 60-minute age-appropriate units. So there are components here, including $40,000 for the contract for the expert in the area of opioids. We would have $30,000 for stipends for educators and required community stakeholders to participate in the development of the curriculum aligned to the statutory requirements of the bill, as well as one-time in-person convening costs of $40,000, and then $6,000 for legal fees to implement the necessary regulatory changes.
Are there any questions from committee members? President Stevens.
Oh, thank you, Madam Chair. So my question, I guess, is what is the proper amount of time to help our kids understand the dangers of this drug? You have come up with 60 minutes. Is that right? Should it be more? Could you cover the curriculum that you need to cover in 60 minutes a year we're talking about? And how did we come to 60 minutes?
Through the chair to Senator Stevens, we would build that based off of the requirements in the bill that requires a curriculum of at least 60 minutes of instruction. So we're going based off of the requirements in the bill.
Senator Rauscher,
for the record, through the chair, Senator Stevens. I think maybe Michael Carson might be the answer for this question.
Mr. Carson, did you hear the question?
Yes, could you please repeat the question so I'm completely clear on exactly what you're expecting?
Mr. Carson, Senator Stevens here, just questioning how we came up with 60 minutes a year. I mean, I don't know if that's enough, but how did you come up with 60 minutes, and can you adequately cover the curriculum for our children in that amount of time per year?
I believe, if I understand the question, is that if 60 minutes one time a year during Red Ribbon Week is adequate, I believe that would be only a start and a beginning. I believe that there needs to be a full curriculum that could be demonstrated or taught in health classes. And I believe, if I'm not mistaken, and maybe the individual that is working are speaking in the room that's associated with BEAD, I believe that the Alaska Health Curriculum might be coming up for review in 2027. Currently, there is no mention of opioids in the current health curriculum in MAPSU, but I believe that probably reflects the whole entire state. So I believe that what we should consider doing is making sure that we have a complete curriculum in our health classes for students so that they can have a full semester on drug prevention and awareness. I hope that is answers your question.
Yes, it does. Thank you, sir.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Carson. And I know, Ms. Manning, curriculum is not necessarily the area in which you work, but if maybe the department could provide us some insight around when is the health curriculum standards up for review, and is there intention to add in some opioid awareness education components into that, I think would be helpful for the committee to understand. Senator Keel.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Ms. Manning, the fiscal note reflects the instructions in the bill. I appreciate that. But we've heard descriptions of some existing curricula that are out there about an hour long. If the instruction were just to sort of tailor an existing curriculum, would the cost go down?
Through Chair Tobin to Senator Keel, yes, the fiscal note reflects the requirement for the department to create the curriculum. But if there is existing, you know, there could be revisions to the language that would allow the department to provide a list of existing curriculum, for example, that would lower the cost. Or could lower the cost, depending on the language.
Senator Keel.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Probably we ought to get the sponsor's take on that as to whether it's a good idea or not. The other question I would have is if we do want to develop or tailor a curriculum specifically to Alaska, is there anyone who knows, would this be an allowable use of the opioid settlement money to address this curriculum so that we aren't using general funds?
Senator Rauscher?
Through the chair, for the record, Senator George Rauscher. So to answer your question, I believe there are three categories that fit that money, and this is actually one of them.
Senator Keel.
Education is one of them.
Thank you.
And maybe, Ms. Manning, if there is a way to think about the funding source and work with the department on possibly finding a different avenue to help us convene a group or potentially look at some existing curricula that we could potentially adapt to help reduce that overall cost. Any additional questions from committee members on this fiscal note? Seeing none, thank you, Ms. Manning. We'll now move on to the second fiscal note, which we are joined by Michael Hughes with the Alaska Department of Health. He is a public health specialist and will walk us through OMB 2818.
For the record, this is Michael Hughes with the Department of Health, Division of Public Health. I did not come prepared to present specifically on the fiscal note, but I can say that it is a zero fiscal note. If you need any specifics beyond that, I'd be happy to follow up with our administrative operations manager and follow up.
Well, thank you, Mr. Hughes. I appreciate that. If we do have any additional questions, we will follow up with the Department of Health with those questions. With that, any additional comments before we move to public testimony? Senator Rauscher.
No, if you want to move to public testimony, that's fine.
Thank you. Thank you, Senator Rauscher. We'll now move to public testimony. I now open public testimony for Senate Bill 228. Is there anyone here in the room who wishes to testify? Seeing no one here in the room, I do believe we have a few folks online. We are joined by, let's see, I think we have first online was Stacy Essert. From Anchorage, Ms. Essert, if you could please identify yourself for the record and begin your testimony. You have 3 minutes.
Hello, my name is Stacy Essert, and I'm calling in today to support SB Senate Bill 228 to implement mandatory opioid abuse awareness and prevention in public schools. And the reason I am passionate about Senate Bill 228 to be passed is because my son, my oldest son, Jason, died from fentanyl poisoning 5 years ago on March 10th at the age of 41. You might be asking yourself, why am I talking about this when my son was age 41 at his death? And this is why. Jason was a teacher at an Anchorage high school and held a master's degree in English literature. He was very passionate about education and loved his students. Jason also had several heartbreaks throughout his life. His best friend died in a terrible car accident at age 25 when he got in his car after a night of drinking and decided to drive home. But he never made it home. One of Jason's roommates hung himself in the house that they were sharing while going to college. And then another very good friend died in his 30s in a freak skateboarding accident. Jason had a difficult time dealing with the heartbreak of losing his good friends. He started self-medicating to escape the reality of loss. Then he turned his life around and he bought a house, got married, and had two little boys. Then his marriage started falling apart and ended in divorce. And he started self-medicating again, which led him to lose his beloved teaching job at the Anchorage School District and also caused him to lose partial custody of his children. He quickly slipped into deep depression and ended up purchasing a counterfeit pill unknowingly laced with a deadly dose of fentanyl. Classic example of one pill can kill. He was found on the bathroom floor by his roommate just a half hour after ingesting the pill. Knowing how much Jason valued education, and if he were still alive, I am certain he would want his beloved students to be educated on the dangers of opioid use and how it can lead to death. I feel he would also tell them that turning to drugs as a coping device for stress or depression can lead to death and heartbreak for their families. To quote one of Jason's students after his death, they stated, "I highly credit my teacher, Jason Isert, as the reason I made it to the other end of a very hard 4 years. If we can spare just one life and one family from experiencing the pain and heartbreak our family has endured through education, then Jason's death will not have been in vain. No parent should have to answer the door to a policewoman telling them their child has perished from something that can be preventable through education. And no family should have to endure a lifetime sentence of grief like our family is enduring. Thank you very much for your time and consideration."
Thank you, Ms. Isert. We'll stay in Anchorage and go to Chris Isert next. Chris, if you can hear us, if you could please identify yourself and begin your testimony. You have 3 minutes.
Hi, my name is Chris Isert. I'm the son of Stacy Isert that just testified. I'm here to testify on behalf of Senate Bill 228. Hello, members of the last state legislature. I'm Chris Isert. I have taught in the Anchorage School District for 18 years. I'm a husband and a father of three boys born and raised in the state. I'm speaking to you today about fentanyl use and awareness in our state. This issue directly affects my life for many reasons. First of all, just like my mom just testified, my brother Jason died from a lethal dose of fentanyl 5 years ago on March 10th, 2021. He always struggled with mental health throughout his life and needed guidance, medication, and counseling. Despite this, he was successful, completed his master's in education, and got landed a job at the same high school that I teach at, South Anchorage High School. During the time the world was coming together, he eventually got married and had a couple children, but unfortunately, relationship struggles compiled with his mental health and past history broke him, and he became suicidal and eventually attempted to check into Providence for care during COVID. And current lack of inpatient public mental health programs in our nation and state, he was released. Providence would not accept him unless he had injured himself or was in physically critical condition. So without access, he turned to drugs and alcohol to numb his emotional strife. And after a long drawn out divorce, he lost the custody of his children, lost his job as a teacher, and began to get into legal trouble. From this state of desperation, he purchased a pill which was laced with fentanyl, and his roommate came home and found him dead in the bathroom on March 10th, 2021. Evidence gathered showed that he had ingested a lethal dose of fentanyl. He left behind two sons, ages 1 and 3 at the time, that will never know him. Due to fentanyl, Jason was robbed from his ability to seek help, improvement, and treatment for his drug and mental health problems. His sons were robbed of their father. Second, I would like to speak as an educator in the state that works with hundreds of students in the high school every level every day. Many teenagers feel they are invincible and they deal with many complex social issues that they are learning how to navigate in this confusing time. Their brains are not fully developed in the hippocampus decision-making region of the brain. I see this evidence every day as working as a teacher and when I get home with my own kids. With the mounting fentanyl crisis and the probability of these substances reaching Alaska's youth only increases, and more tragedies like this one will eventually find their way into our inner circles. As an educator, I implore the state to consider funding a program to educate and inform our youth of the dangers of fentanyl so that they are aware of the risks if they ever find themselves in these situations. Just like Bree's Law and Aaron's Law, the state should implement a program with appropriate delivery of this information within the schools. As in the case of my brothers and the state's track record of mental health, I would encourage placing a rider on this bill that could offer some preventative measures such as supports for mental health. From my experience, the root cause of the demand of drugs laced with fentanyl. These measures are important to supporting our youth, protecting the state, and the dangers of these generations will face. The fentanyl crisis has claimed more lives than some U.S. wars combined, and is a direct attack on our civilians pushed by our adversaries. Education and awareness beginning with Alaska's youth is an imperative step towards defense against this invasion coming for our loved ones. Thank you for your time, and I hope you will take my story into consideration while you deliberate on this bill.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Isert. We'll stay in Anchorage and now hear from Aaron Osterbeck. Mr. Osterbeck, if you could please identify yourself for the record and begin your testimony. You have 3 minutes.
Yes, my name's Aaron Osterbeck, and I'm calling in from Anchorage, Alaska, for the record. I'm a lifelong Alaskan. I grew up in the Aleutians, but I've lived out in Anchorage for the past 26 years. So go back generations through both rural and urban Alaska. I do want to take the time to acknowledge and thank the Education Committee today for taking the time to hear on Senate Bill 228. So thank you to the committee, as well as Senator George Rauscher from Sutton for sponsoring this bill. A little bit about my personal self. I've actually had a relative a few years ago pass away in my hometown from fentanyl poisoning. In kind of a similar fashion, she was out to some of the stories that were shared earlier. She was out partying with friends and unfortunately was provided a drug that had fentanyl in it. And when she overdosed, her friends were afraid of getting in trouble and left her where they were partying, and she went missing for a couple of days. When the community did finally find her, she was dead from a fentanyl overdose. She had a young daughter at the time who is now being raised up by the mother's parents. Just as of last year, I lost another friend to an overdose from fentanyl stateside who I grew up with. And so just in context, I come from a small enough community that my graduating class was 6 people. So to me, losing a classmate was like losing a sibling. And so just the personal side of it and seeing how much it's impacting communities in general, this is a really important issue and topic for me. But also in the field that I work in, I also work in prevention. And so I spend a lot of time, there's a lot of familiar names here that I've worked with and have come to know, and really great people that are putting a lot of work and effort towards making sure youth are educated on the dangers of fentanyl. So I really appreciate the folks that are here on this call today. If anything else, I really want to share, I know there's questions about Red Ribbon Week, and I think we need to spend more time. I think Red Ribbon Week is great, and the resources that are allocated to that are something that is really important and need to continue. With Counter Drug and the DA and everybody else coming out to educate youth, but also I feel like we need to continue to have these messages going on throughout the school year. Having this bill move forward will help support Healthy Alaskans Initiative 2030. So just putting it out there that Healthy Alaskan 17 encourages an increase of percentages of adolescents with who report that there are 3 or more adults who they feel comfortable seeking help from. If we're educating youth and we're talking about this and having conversations, they're going to feel like they can have that confidence and talk to teachers or even counselors or other adults in their lives. And then Healthy Alaskans 18 asks that percentages of adolescents who feel like they matter to people in their community. Also, when we're taking the time to build these relationships and have these conversations, youth tend to feel like they are being heard. I've heard a few testimonies here where youth are facing challenges and they shouldn't be facing those alone. So if we have curriculum into the schools like this where adults can come in and have conversations, then youth feel like they're being part of that community as well. It's not just about school and education, which is equally important, but that there's community members out there that have their best interests in mind as well who are working in this field. Just one last note I'll say is that ASD, I just want to give them kudos. They do keep track of suspensions throughout the year. This year alone, there's 315 reported suspensions as of March 10th, and 46% of those suspensions were related to street drugs, and unfortunately they don't break that down per drugs, but fentanyl would be incorporated into those percentages. So just to rationalize that, 46% of this year's suspensions were around street drugs, and that's my testimony. Thank you for taking the time to hear me.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Osterbeck. We do have a question for you, Mr. Osterbeck. Senator Bjorkman.
Thank you for your testimony. I'm wondering.
Oh, you're welcome.
My question is, would vaping materials count under that definition of street drugs?
No, vaping is actually separate. So the way that they categorize the substance or suspensions for substances, there's several different categories, and I'll list them out really quick. Like, one's alcohol, one is e-cigarettes and vapes, has their own category. Prescription drugs is another. Smoking and tobacco under traditional format is its own, and then street drugs is its own.
Understood. Thank you. Good to know.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Osterbeck. Seeing as there's no one else online, I will now close public testimony. We're going to hold Senate Bill 228 until a future meeting. If folks could work with my office and the bill sponsor on any amendments, we'll also work with the department on the fiscal notes and whether there's other funding streams to help support the work. Any closing or wrap-up comments, Senator Rauscher?
For the record, Senator Rauscher, I just want to thank the committee through the chair. I appreciate the fact that you heard the bill.
Thank you. Thank you, Senator Rauscher. We'll now move on to our last two items on our agenda for the day. We are bringing back Senate Bill 187, sponsored by Senator Wilkowski. Senate Bill 187 was first heard on February 25th. We do have a committee substitute at the request of the bill sponsor. The committee substitute has been distributed to committee members. It is under work draft labeled 34-LS0846/N. Senator Wilkowski's legislative intern, Phoebe Peber, is here with us to explain the changes. If you could please identify yourself for the record and walk us through the difference from version A to version N.
Thank you, Madam Chair. For the record, my name is Phoebe Pepper, intern to Senator Wilkowski. I would like to thank you all for a second hearing of Senate Bill 187 and for your collaboration in addressing the concerns from the last hearing that are resolved in SB 187 version N. The changes are as follows. Page 1, lines 6 through 7, changes school nutrition or meal program to read breakfast or lunch provided by the school to enrolled students during a school day to clarify that synthetic food dyes are only prohibited for meals served to students by the school, school during the school day. Page 2, line 2, updates the effective date to January 1st, 2028, in alignment with the school district's request to ensure that they have a comfortable amount of time to implement this change.
Thank you. Thank you, Ms. Pepper. Are there any questions from committee members? Seeing none, President Stevens.
Madam Chair, I move to adopt the committee substitute for Senate Bill 187, Work Order 34-LS0846/N as our working document.
Seeing no objection, Work Order 34-LS0846/N is adopted as our working document. Any additional comments before we take action on the legislation?
No, Madam Chair. Thank you.
Thank you. Well, if it is the committee's will, I intend to move Senate Bill 187 from committee. President Stevens.
Madam Chair, I move to report Senate Bill 187, Work Order 34-LS0846/N from the Senate Education Committee with individual recommendations and attached zero fiscal note. The Senate Education Committee gives legislative legal the authority to make technical and conforming changes to the bill.
Without objection, Senate Bill 187, Work Order 34-LS0846/N, as in gnome, is reported from the Senate Education Committee with individual recommendations and attached zero fiscal note. I ask folks to stay behind after today's meeting to sign the committee report. Moving on. Oh. And we are joined by Senator Wilkowski. Any questions or anything you'd like to say as we've just moved your legislation? On our final item on the agenda today is Senate Bill 110, Museum Construction Grants, sponsored by Senate State Affairs. We first heard this bill on April 2nd, 2025, and also on March 2nd. If it is the committee's will, I'd like to move Senate Bill 110 from the Senate Education Committee. President Stevens.
Just 1 minute here. Okay. I move to report Senate Bill 110, Work Order 34-LS0645-G from the Senate Education Committee with individual recommendations and attached fiscal notes. The Senate Education Committee gives the legislative legal the authority to make technical and conforming changes to the bill.
Without objection, Senate Bill 110, Work Order 34-LS0645-G, as in Gullivan, like the Nome Gullivan race that was this past weekend, is reported from the Senate Education Committee with individual recommendations and attached fiscal notes. I ask folks to please stay behind the committee to sign the report. This concludes our agenda for today. The next meeting of the Senate Education Committee is scheduled for Monday, March 23rd at 3:30 p.m. As there is no other business before us today, I will adjourn us at 4:35 p.m.